Dinge. Glad to have you with us. It's our regular monthly show on personal finance, investing, money management, and we hope we can answer some questions for you. If you have questions, you're certainly welcome to call. Our guest this morning is Kevin Wasby. He's a lecturer in the Department of Finance at University of Illinois. He's been here on the show before, and we're pleased to have him back. And we'll try and talk generally about what's going on with the market here a little bit to start. But if you have specific questions, you call in and you can talk with Kevin, and I know he'll do his best to give you an answer. Here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line, good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. 333-WILL, toll-free, 800-222-WILL. Well, thanks very much for being here.
Thank you, David. I always enjoy being here with you.
So periodically in the news, we know that there are going to be stories about companies that are having a tough time. And just today, for example, Ford Motor Company says they expect to be laying off something between 4,000 and 5,000 white-collar workers. The other big news today is Dell, lower-than-expected earnings. The market responds, opening lower. Okay. So here we have two companies, really, that are different. One, a traditional sort of old-line industry, car maker, which used to be one of those things we thought of as being the bedrock of the economy. Now here's the other company. This is the new bedrock of the new company. You know, their economy. They're a computer maker. Two very different companies, but both some bad news and the market response. So here I'm thinking about looking at that and saying, well, okay, from that you should be able to maybe learn something about what's going on at Ford and what's going on at Dell. But does that really tell you something about the economy as a whole?
Good question. Just to maybe expand on that a little bit, you know, a few years ago, it was the popular phrase, new economy stocks, new economy companies, in opposed to the old economy, the smokestack industry type, Ford Motor Company as an example. I guess one thing to remind ourselves of is there's a common feature. Whether it's a new economy or old economy stock, the commonality is it's in our economy. So we've talked now and we've seen more and more evidence as time has gone on that the U.S. economy is not growing as fast as it has been over the past 10 years. There's speculation that it may even be contracting, or people using the word recession. So, you know, however we want to define technically what a recession is, the bottom line is the economy is slowing. Less product is being sold. Fewer people perhaps are needed at those companies, whether they manufacture computer components or automobiles. So the bottom line is there is still very, very much alive a thing called a business cycle. The economy goes through periods where it grows faster than normal, slower than normal, and normal. And it's kind of a cyclical process.
Are there any companies that are not subject to the business cycle, or is everyone subject to it?
There are companies that are thought to be defensive industry companies. Again, an example or two might be something like a pharmaceutical company. The logic there is people need prescription drugs, whether the economy is growing fast, normally, or slow. Perhaps retail grocery companies. People go shopping at the grocery store, whether the economy is doing well, normal, or less than normal. So those types of industries are considered to be defensive, but it doesn't make them immune to economic cycles either. There is still the propensity for those companies to be affected by the level of activity in the economy, but perhaps not as much as something that would be automobiles, computers, whatever.
Yeah, the kinds of stuff that maybe you people don't necessarily need, and one of those things that if they have discretionary money, they might say, okay, now's the time for a new car. But if they don't, then they might say, well, we just got to keep the old car going. So maybe not this year, maybe not next year,
You know. Exactly. And hopefully something like groceries or prescription medications would be those things that, you know, they would have to have it regardless. So,
I do wonder when you again taking this this case where, you know, here on one day we have this news about Ford and Dell, and we do think of them as being old economy, new economy kind of companies. At the same time, they're both manufacturing companies. Mm-hmm. One just makes cars, one makes computers. And I do wonder, are these two companies really all that different?
I've never thought of them as being all that different in the basic operation of their business. They are in the business of manufacturing and selling a product. The products are obviously different. The products obviously have different markets and different demand functions that, that play against the supply of those products. But in the bottom line, they're both manufacturers and purveyors of equipment, for the lack of a better term. The automobile market is certainly a much different market. Many people who have a car don't need to replace it necessarily. The people that want a car and still need a car have a variety of used cars to choose from, so they don't necessarily have to go to a manufacturer and buy new. 10 years ago, we would not have made the same statement about computers. People that had a computer at home 10 years ago were in a very, very small minority. And that's changed greatly. So market penetration of personal computers is definitely greater now than it was 10 years ago. So it's not surprising, perhaps, that a company like Dell or Gateway or Apple 10 years ago was considered to be a super growth company and did experience tremendous growth in the sales of their products because they were selling into a market that was not very highly penetrated. People wanting personal computers at home were in the huge majority, and those that had them at home already were the, you know, count them on one hand. But anymore, we might have made the same statement if we think back 10 years prior to that, say 20 years ago, about the business of video cassette machines. 20 years ago, the number of people that had a video cassette machine at home were in a small minority. And as the video cassette machines became more in demand and prices fell, more and more people bought them. And my guess is that if we went into an average American home today, if we found a television, we'd probably find a VCR. So, you know, and again, we could back up another 10, maybe 20 years past that and say how many people 40 years ago or 50 years ago had a television in their house. And was that a color television? And the market for color televisions finally got saturated. So, you know, however you want to look up the statistics, I mean, I don't know how many televisions you have in your house, but my guess is more than one. And my guess is that they are both or all color. So, again, market penetration, it's nothing more than product life cycles and the development of markets throughout everything we as consumers want to consume.
Our guest here this morning, Kevin Wasby, he's a lecturer in the Department of Finance at U of I. This is our monthly show on investing, money management. If you have questions, you should call here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line, and that one is good anywhere that you can hear us. That is 800-222-9455. You match the letters with the numbers on the phone, you get WILL, which may or may not make it any easier. It never makes it easier for me that way, but I sort of mentioned that. 333-WILL and toll-free, 800-222-WILL. Well, let me ask you about a different subject. Certainly, when we've talked before and just about any time you get on this subject and people talk about investing, the big thing that you always need to remind people is that you need to diversify to reduce your risk. And so, therefore, most people, if they want to invest in the stock market and they're counseled to have some of their money in stocks, the best thing for people to do is go into a mutual fund. That way, they can spread their risk across many stocks, more than they could do if they were going to go out and put together their own portfolio. Okay. And having said that, then, you look at different kinds of funds. There are those funds where somebody decides today where we're going to put the money, and they're actively managed. And then there are those funds where they just have some kind of a formula that they use to to figure out what they're going to invest in. But generally, they invest broadly. And there are, for example, funds that invest in the S&P 500, the 500 biggest companies. Okay, so I'm just for grins here. I'm looking at the website here, the New York Times, and in the business section, they have a place where you can go and you can look at how a number of funds are doing. How do they do over the last week? Mm-hmm. So I go along and I put in S and it says particular category of fund you want to look. And I say, okay, so show me S&P 500 funds. So I do that and their returns are all over the place. And some of them are even negative. And I'm thinking, now how can that be? They're all S&P 500 funds. Shouldn't their returns all be the same or very close? So I guess first of all, then I want to ask, well, now how is that? Why is it that they're not all the same?
Well, the New York Times listing, like many financial publications listings, whether it's the Times, the Wall Street Journal, whatever, there's an awful lot of information available within the listings in the tables, but it's all in thumbnail sketch form. So I guess what I'd have to say is, I'd have to look at those funds' full description to see exactly what kind of fund it is and how they're managing those investments. They might be index-related funds without being true index funds, and that might be an explanation as to different levels of performance in the same time period. So, again, without literally looking at a full description, and full descriptions are usually easy to come by. Most fund companies, of course, on their own homepage will have indices where you can go to look at either a complete description or even the prospectus itself, which is the legal document that must be supplied to investors before they invest. The prospectus itself will say exactly what the fund does and how it does it. So, in other words, if it's a fund that is meant to replicate the performance of the Standard & Poor's 500 index, it'll spell it out, and it'll say what they can and cannot do. The funds that are showing different performances may do different things. They may use derivative securities, options, or futures to enhance or change returns. They may use leverage. They may borrow money. So there's a lot of different ways that those funds can appear, at least in a thumbnail sketch, to be the same type of funds, but in their operations be doing things that are differently, which can cause different rates of return results. So investigation is probably the next step that you or I or anybody else would have to do. If we really wanted to find a true mirror of the Standard & Poor's 500 or any other index as a mutual fund to invest in, it's going to require a little bit of due diligence on your part to do some more in-depth reading.
So if that's what you wanted, that's possible.
Sure.
But then so the bottom line here is to, if you're thinking about this, all S&P 500 funds are not the same. You should look at their descriptions of what they do when you're deciding, do I want to invest in this fund here or this one over here?
Right. I would make that statement again if we were to look at something like the New York Times or the Wall Street Journal, just as a quote page type of way to find a mutual fund that is called a quote-unquote index fund. So other sources that are available, there's a service called Morningstar. Morningstar runs a website. Morningstar is a subscription-based service, so you know, depending upon what information you get from their website or from their print media reports, you might have to pay for, unless, of course, you go to the library. And if a person were to go to their local library, at least in Champaign-Urbana, it's very easy to find Morningstar reports on different mutual funds. And Morningstar does a one-page review on the mutual funds, and their groupings then are a lot more succinct than what we might find in a daily newspaper quote section. So in other words, if I were to look up index funds in Morningstar, then I would be looking at probably a much greater opportunity of comparing apples to apples.
Okay. We have a caller in Peoria. Others are certainly welcome. You got questions, you can give us a call. 333-9455 for Champaign-Urbana folks. Toll-free, 800-222-9455. Here we'll start with someone in Peoria. Line number four. Hello.
Yes, good morning. I'm interested in tax-free bonds. Now, a number of years ago, we put our farm into a land trust for the second generation. That way it would make it tax-free when my wife and I pass on.
Mm-hmm. A very wise and common move in estate planning, in many people's estate plans. And you're interested in municipal bonds now?
Tax-free.
Uh-huh. Tax-free or municipal bonds are issued by states and subdivisions of states, counties, municipalities, perhaps cities, school districts, so on and so forth. Municipal bonds are not all created equal, so to speak. So a person can find a very large spectrum of quality in municipal bonds, in tax-free bonds. And like most investments, for many people, the way to buy municipal bonds that makes sense from a diversification and affordability point of view is probably through a mutual fund.
The reason I say this is because if you put your money into a bank at 4% and you pay taxes on that, you might as well just keep the money in the clothes closet.
Well, I don't know if I'd go that far. I'm a proponent of lower tax rates myself, but I guess on the flip side, I'd still have to say that our income tax rates are still below 100%, so it's still going to leave me something as a positive. But you've brought up an interesting and very true relationship. The relationship is, what is my tax bracket, and how beneficial then is a tax-free yield to me? But that said, when we look, if we could try to compare the dynamics or the characteristics of a tax-free yield potential, whether it's an individual municipal bond or a mutual fund of municipal bonds, if we could try to keep all of the characteristics of that and a taxable yield investment the same, we would have to realize that the yield on those municipal issues or that fund is going to be lower than the same quality, same term to maturity, same other characteristic taxable yield. I mean, that's just a fact of life. They are instruments that are tax exempt. So if a 10-year, very high quality, let's use a treasury bond, for example, U.S. Treasury, which you will pay federal income tax on the interest income from, is currently yielding 5.5%. By default, you know, I know, everyone else should logically know that if we looked at a 10-year to maturity, very high quality, tax-free investment potential, that same yield is not going to be there. It'll be something below that because the investor in that doesn't have to pay the federal income tax.
Right.
Now the only question is, how do we compare the taxable to the non-taxable yield? And that's just nothing more than simple arithmetic. You can take that tax-exempt yield and divide it by the complement of your tax rate to produce what's called the taxable equivalent. And that's, you know, an easy, again, just simple arithmetic that you or I or anybody else could do when we were looking at comparing these two alternatives.
Thank you.
All right. Other comments, questions are certainly welcome. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Also, we have that toll-free line. That's 800-222-9455. If it would be a long-distance call for you, use that number, and we'll save you some money there on the call. Our guest this morning, Kevin Waspy, he's a lecturer in the Department of Finance at University of Illinois. It's our monthly show on personal finance. So, again, if you have questions, you can give us a call. Just for a second, to go back to the topic we were talking about before, about the fact that if you decide you want to invest in a mutual fund, an S&P 500 fund, you need to look at how it is that fund it decides where the money is invested, and that they're not all the same. Is there anything that you would say people should particularly pay attention to as they look at how it is that fund decides to do what it does?
Well, I think if there's any rule of thumb to follow, it is however comfortable you, I, or any other individual is to do their own research will determine the level, the depth of the research that you want to do. At some point, you may decide you know enough, or you've experienced enough pain in researching that you've come upon enough knowledge to make your decision, and that's fine. The common thread that runs through any investment, I mean, if we really wanted to look at the definition of an investment, is the fact that there is no guarantee. An investment is not a gamble, okay? There is a very, very big difference between gambling and investing. But we also have to remind ourselves that an investment is not guaranteed. So if I wanted to have the security of a known return in advance of making that money fit the place that it resides, I have to rule out anything that I would call a true investment. That's where we talk about the differentiation between savings and investments. Investments are those things that will vary in value over time, and that means they can go down in value as well as up. Savings are those things that are always the money put there plus a rate of return promised. Mm-hmm. And they're very different. It's been shown in countless studies over and over that it's really, in most instances, not the where the money ends up as a which stock, which bond, which asset question, but how the money is allocated that drives most of the investment return. In other words, what proportion of the amount of wealth that we're talking about allocating ends up in savings vehicles? What proportion ends up in fixed income vehicles? What proportion ends up in equity stock vehicles? So, again, the topic of asset allocation, where the money that you're talking about putting away for the future, these deferred spending dollars end up, the places they end up as broad categories is much more important than the individual assets that they end up in. So asset allocation is a first step that is a very most important step.
We've got a call here. We've got several, in fact. Someone on a cell phone, so we'll get them first. Line one in Champaign. Hello?
Hello?
Yes, go ahead.
I'm sorry. Kevin, enjoying your show very much. I had a question about college savings, the 529 plans. My time horizon's 18 years. I have a newborn daughter. And I was looking at several states, and they all have different plans. And I'm not sure if I should go with an age-based plan or just in one state or in several states, or diversify even more. And if you have any insight on that, that would be appreciated. I'll hang up and listen to you. Thanks.
Thank you for the call. All right.
That's a great question, and I only wish I had a great answer for it. The 529 plans, the college savings plans, whatever moniker we give them, at this stage of the game are so many and so varied and, in my opinion, so convoluted that it really is kind of a wilderness-type situation. Everybody has to kind of blaze their own trail, in my estimation of things. There's very little commonality between different states' plans and different possibilities people have. So for this caller and anyone else interested in this question, I'm going to disappoint you very severely when I tell you this is something that is trailblazing. And you can walk through the trail alone, or you can talk to a financial consultant if you wish and have the benefit of their cutting down some of the saplings and blazing the trails. But I just don't think there's an interstate in this part of the wilderness. There's no well-beaten path. There's no yes-no type of answers. There are no this is better than that type of conclusions that we can come to yet. The whole topic is too new and too unconnected from state to state, from plan to plan, from opportunity to opportunity. So it's a messy field.
There's a niche there for somebody to move in, for someone who maybe perhaps already does investment counseling, to add on a little thing that says, we'll help you figure that one out.
There is that niche, and even still, I would say that niche or the benefit of those persons' ability to advise is not to direct you to the interstate, the quickest, how should we say, route to your destination, but rather, you know, these are the pitfalls, and let's stay out of this swamp, and let's stay out of this quagmire. But still, we're going to have to hack our way through the woods here and try to make the best for you out of it. It's just too much of a piecemeal type of process, at least right now. Hopefully, you know, my hopes would be that any potential tax simplification over the future, and that's a oxymoron if we ever heard of one, but any goal I would have in trying to simplify tax legislation in this country would involve that aspect very deeply and put college savings potentials, whether they're whatever section of the code, but these types of plans all on the same kind of level playing field. It would be a great service to the American taxpayer and to people trying to save money for the education of their dependents.
Okay. We'll go on here to someone in Urbana, line 4. Hello.
Two related questions about mutual funds. Recently, I have seen the term CORE, C-O-R-E, in the stat tables in the Wall Street Journal, where they show the top winners and top losers among mutual funds, according to categories. One day it'll be small cap value, and another day it'll be international. And then every so often they'll say something like small cap core, or maybe value core funds. I hadn't encountered that term before the last few months. Does it have some meaning? Does it mean index or what?
I'm not quite sure of that. I don't think it means index. Is the footnote section to that part of the paper of any help?
Not really, although I could take another look at it. The data comes apparently from the Lippert Company.
Mm-hmm.
It's a box score that appears about 2 pages from the end of Section C.
Mm-hmm.
Every day. And I think Lippert Company shuffled all of their categories a couple of years ago. Maybe Morningstar did too. And apparently the general intention was to make more clear the categories that they were arranging the funds under in order to compare. Okay. Second question is another mutual fund puzzler, although maybe not a puzzler. Money market mutual funds, apparently about starting this past spring, maybe month of May, within the big fund families like Fidelity or American Century or Vanguard and one or two others, those that are big enough to offer two or three or four or even five different money market funds, the winner in each of those mutual fund families has been either Treasury money market fund or U.S. government money market fund. Would you guess, Mr. Wasby, that's likely to be a long-term leadership position, or do you think it may be a fluke from May until August or September, and then the non-government-oriented money market mutual funds may resume their former leadership position?
Over the long haul, I'd expect the treasuries or government money market funds to be the lowest yielding because of the fact that the paper those fund managers are buying are the lowest risk securities that we can buy. In other words, things like U.S. Treasury bills, which have no default risk, in opposed to a money market fund that buys corporate obligations such as commercial paper, IOUs issued by companies, and since the Department of the Treasury still has the Bureau of Engraving and Printing beneath them, and those are the folks that have the paper, ink, presses, and plates that make our money, those are the people that are the only people that can say that there is no risk of default in the issuance of their debt. The corporations don't have those presses, plates, ink, and paper to be able to make that statement.
Yeah, that makes sense. And in fact, I was floored starting in May when I noted this. In fact, a big money market amount of my own investments, which I have been holding in money market recently, I had not had there. But after seeing four or five consecutive weeks within the Fidelity Group, I moved a big chunk of my savings with Fidelity into what they call the Government Retirement Money Market Fund. And I think I had it previously in Fidelity Cash Reserves, because week after week after week, starting in May and never missing, Cash Reserves was taking back seat. And Fidelity's Government Retirement, which is opposed, I think, to just Fidelity Government, it's that Fidelity Government Money Market Fund available to people who participate in retirement plans, like 403 or 401. And I was as surprised as I guess you are, but it has remained consistently week after week since May. Maybe there have been a lot of defaults in the corporate-based money market funds or something that has knocked them down a bit and allowed the government agency-type funds to take leadership since May. I'm still somewhat puzzled over that.
Yeah. Rather than that, I mean, what I would have to also say is the first thing that I'm assuming is that the operation of each one of those funds is equivalent or similar. In other words, the Fidelity Treasury or Government Retirement Money Market Fund is able and doing nothing materially different from what the corporate money market fund is doing.
We hope in
regards to things like repurchase agreements and other techniques they can use to enhance the yield. But I will tell you that, you know, what we've been seeing with the monetary policy in our country from the beginning of the year, the Federal Reserve has seven times taken action to try to push short-term interest rates lower in our economy, and it's been a very concerted effort. It's been a time where their efforts in doing that have brought yields in money market instruments to be out of the normal type of relationships.
Maybe that's part of it. Okay.
And I think much of it, again, if we can make the assumption correctly that the operating differences between the two mutual funds, if the only difference is whether the paper is commercial obligations or treasury obligations, everything else being the same, then I would say the results that you've seen are 99% due to what's been going on with interest rates in this country, the actions of the Fed, and how those actions have been played through different instruments. And the second thing might be, if we were to look at the average maturity of the funds, if the managers of those treasury funds had been buying longer-term paper, maybe 35, 40-day average paper, in opposed to a 10 or 15 day average paper. In other words, they've been able to take advantage of a little bit longer lock on those rates that were higher a month ago, in opposed to as rates have been falling.
Okay, thank you very much, sir.
All
bye
right,
bye.
Very good. Let's go on to another Urbana person. This is line two. Hello.
Yes. I wondered if you could tell me about what is the most recent academic research on the value of index funds. Is it still as strong as it had been, you know, 10 years ago, 15 years ago? And particularly with regard not only to index funds, but to different asset classes within index funds.
Yeah, I would have to say that in my knowledge of the topic, the research still supports broad market diversification. In other words, picking stocks or picking asset classes as a process of fundamental analysis, some kind of a timing mechanism or technical analysis, still is, it doesn't work. It is borne out in study after study, most recent ones included, that look at actively managed mutual funds or investments of large institutional accounts and compare them to an unmanaged index. And again, in any reasonable period of time, 3 years, 5 years, 10 year running periods, the unmanaged or index approach is still, it's the cheapest way, first of all, and it's still the most risk adjusted, rewarding way.
And then within index funds, does it still support as much diversifying within different asset classes, indexing?
Yes. Again, the conclusion that I would come to, even with the most recent results, is that the important question in an investment process is still the first question, and that is the issue of asset allocation.
Uh-huh.
That still shows to be the large majority driver in investment returns that a person garners.
Okay. Thank you.
All right.
Thank you.
We have about 10 minutes left in this part of Focus 580. It's our monthly show on personal finance. Kevin Waspy is our guest. He's a lecturer in finance at the U of I. And if you have questions, call us. Don't wait till the very end. 333-9455. Toll free, 800-222-9455. Again, let's say sticking with this mutual fund topic for a little bit here. I suppose one of the very first things, if someone is thinking, well, okay, where am I going to invest my money, after they've made a general decision about what type of fund, they want to know, well, how is this fund done? And here again, I'm not meaning to boost the New York Times, but here on their business page, there's a mutual fund finder, and you can do your search according to different types of funds, and also you can adjust the time period for the return. So you can say, okay, show me what this has done in the last week. Show me what's done in the last month, the last 1 year, 3 years, 5 years, 10 years. You can go all the way back to the time the fund started.
The inception, sure.
The inception date. So there, if you're wanting to get a good handle on, well, how is this fund done? I guess maybe the bottom line is you could say, okay, how is it done since this fund came into being? But what do you think is a good time horizon to evaluate the performance of a fund?
That's a good question, and one of the things that that I think needs to go into the answer of how that's done, if we're talking about actively managed funds, which I presume we are, I would also like to see how long the person who's currently the manager of the fund has been managing it. The example I'll give you is, not to pick on anybody, but Fidelity's Magellan Fund had a very envious and still has a tremendously good track record. If one were to look back at the past 10, 15 years or even back to its inception, a lot of that record was built by Peter Lynch, who's, become famous in that and other investment activities. Peter Lynch is occasionally seen still in the Fidelity commercials. The white-haired gentleman who had a stunning 11-year track record as the manager of that fund. But since his retirement as the manager of that fund, there have been three other people manage it, some not so long and some have been there a little longer. But the bottom line is, the fund is like the trade name, but the proprietor is the person you meet when you walk in the front door and see them behind the counter. And I think as important as the trade name, you'd probably be well to look at how long that proprietor has been behind the counter. So a track record is only the first place to perhaps look to ask the question, how have they done?
Okay. We have several callers. In fact, the lines are full. So we'll try to get everybody. The first, we'll go to someone calling from a car phone there outside Indianapolis, right here on line three. Hello.
Hello. I'm not sure if my connection's real good. I really wanted to touch base on the asset allocation on age, your age compared to your asset allocation.
Well, I'd say, I think maybe we lost the caller, but I think I got the drift. There is, I'm sorry. I think we're going to, hopefully that guy will turn on his radio because I think I know what he was getting at. there's sort of this basic idea that says one of the things you think about how you allocate your assets and how much risk you want to have is how long before you expect to retire. So I know that there has been always a sort of a basic rule of thumb that says, you know, take your age and subtract a number of years and what, you know, whatever that whatever that formula is. And it says, then it will say that's how much you should be on in stocks. And that the idea is that as you get older and you get closer to retirement, you want to be less and less in stocks and more perhaps in things where you know that they're going to be more secure. You're not going to lose money. There's less volatility. What do you think about the idea of asset allocation, how you decide where you want that money to go, particularly with relationship to your age?
Right. It's very logical and it's very common. Basically, what we're talking about is the life cycle investment process. As a person gets closer to need the money for living expenses, so many people think of the first event that happens being retirement. As they get closer to the need of that money, it makes sense that that money should be at less risk. So whether it's retirement, beginning of a process called payment of tuition, board and room, so on and so forth for college education expenses, whatever that event is, it only makes sense to be slimming down those assets that are at risk as we get closer to the actual need of the money. So that's the life cycle of investments in a nutshell. The people that are furthest away from the need of the money have the opportunity and can afford financially, at least, to take the greatest amount of risk. Now, that being said, I've always talked with people about allocating their money in the financial risk capability, but also in the psychological risk. If you can't sleep at night, then I don't care what theory says. I don't care what the financial risks that everyone would look at and say, this is what you should be doing. If it doesn't make sense to you and you're not comfortable with it, don't do it. That's the bottom line.
Okay. Is there indeed some kind of rule, a hard and fast rule, though?
I wouldn't say there's a hard and fast rule for the very reason of what I just said. We can start with a guideline. When a person's 20 years away from retirement, maybe the most they should have in assets other than equities would be 20%. So in other words, 80% devoted to equities, 15% fixed income, 5% cash, maybe even no cash, 20% fixed income. As they get closer and closer to retirement, those percentages are adjusted accordingly so that they're perhaps only 40%, 30% in equities. But as we're thinking about that issue of retirement, if we're really thinking about living in our retirement and working now again with any kind of expected lifespan or so on and so forth, we'd really never be out of equities entirely. That's perhaps a common compensation people make. Gee, I turned 65. I'm going to retire next week. They're throwing a party for me, and all of my money is now in fixed income investments. And my question is, do you plan to die then too? Because if you don't, you know, there's also the opportunity for you to experience that, you know, decline in purchasing power now as you live the remaining 32 years of your expected life. Yeah. You still have the need for equity investments.
Okay. Well, I hope that I hope that indeed was the question of the caller. That sounded to me like where he was going, and unfortunately he kind of broke up, and hope that helps. Let's go back here to Urbana Line 1 for another caller. Hello.
Good morning. I really like munis, especially at tax time. And I wanted to add something to the speaker's offering. One, yes, you can do your own study and select individual municipal bonds. Or the other extreme is you can go into mutual. But the in-between is what I really enjoy, and that is having my personal broker call me. That's particularly important in Illinois because Illinois is very selective about what bonds it will allow to have not collect tax on. And so I just have an understanding with my broker that she will call me whenever there are double exempt municipal bonds available. And that's just wonderful. And why not get them double exempt as long as they are available? So I just wanted to add that in between either going to a mutual fund or doing the study yourself.
Absolutely. A great point. Coming from a history of being in the financial services industry for the past almost 20 years, my bias is, you know, not, how should I say, it's not in favor of people excluding financial planners from their lives.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
Oh, sure.
So, yeah, I think what you're saying is you have a good relationship with a broker, financial consultant, whatever title we want to use. And that's great. That's great. I think that's probably the best of all worlds, in my personal opinion, as it comes to making investment decisions rather than a person doing their own work.
Right. Well, she knows what I want, and so she doesn't bother me about other things. But it's almost always something that I act on because I like those double exempt bonds.
Right, and I trust a physician more so than my own abilities at self-healing for some of the very same reasons, the specialization, the knowledge they have.
I don't want to do the study that she does.
And
do other things.
And again, I don't want to read the medical journals to stay up with the latest studies and clinical experiences.
Sure. Well, I just wanted to add that so that people felt, well, if I'm not going to do it myself, then I need to go into mutuals. And I think it's more fun to know where it is and what the entity is, and you know the percentage.
Excellent point.
It can be called, but you know that. And so right now, because of the interest rates being down, some of those munis are very good, and of course they'll be called, but they've still been good over the years. So I just wanted to add that.
Excellent
okay.
point.
Thank you.
We'll try to squeeze one more person in here real quick in Champaign, line two. Hello.
Oh, hello.
Yes.
The mutual funds have not been doing too well lately, and I was wondering how you thought REIT would do now.
REITs meaning real estate investment
yes.
trusts?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. REITs are very interesting investment vehicles. Let me say up front, what I don't want to do is make a guess as to how they're going to do. And the reason I say that is because I'm used to putting both feet in my mouth at the same time, and that's very comfortable for me because, you know, if somebody's going to say, well, what's your feelings here, Kevin? Where are things going to go? Hey, I can make a fool of myself. I've done it so many times, it's pathetic. But the bottom line is the more important question I think that you or I or anybody else should be asking and hopefully finding an answer to is this. Do REITs, do real estate investment trusts, which proxy for an investment in real estate, do they make sense in an asset allocation decision for you? And that's kind of, again, I'm not trying to cop out, because I'll give you an answer to your question directly in just a minute. I think that's the first and the most important question. REITs are very interesting vehicles and can, if they are the proper instruments, the proper type of REIT, be a very good investment vehicle that can satisfy the component of a real estate investment within a person's portfolio. And they've got advantages and disadvantages as compared to actual ownership of property itself. But generally speaking, something that shouldn't be overlooked. Now, I'll answer your question directly. How do I think they're going to do in the next 6 months or a year? Which would you like? Or both?
Yeah, go about 30 seconds.
Both.
30 seconds, okay? In the next 6 months, they're going to do relatively little. In the next 6 months, they're going to do a little bit better.
Thank you.
All right. Well, we're going to have to go because we're used our time. I want to say thanks very much to Kevin Wasby.
Thank you, David.
Appreciate your time. Kevin Wasby's lecturer in Department of Finance.